Okay, actually, we were discussing Parabhava Sutta, and that is actually another sutta available in Sutta Nipata, one of the ancient books available in the Kuddaka Nikaya. As you know, there are several Nikayas according to the Theravada tradition, and Digha Nikaya, long discourses, Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses. Kuddaka Nikaya is the short discourses. And among them, one of the very important book is the Sutta Nipata, where various ancient sermons are included, like Mangala Sutta, Parabhava Sutta, Vasala Sutta, then Karaniya Metta Sutta. Likewise, many known to us suttas are available there. Now, Parabhava Sutta, on the other hand, is different, because it is asked by the questions. Actually, the questions are asked by one of the deities, we can say a deva. And he approached the Buddha during the night time and illuminating the whole Jetavanarama. Now he asks a question very much like asking for us. Actually, the answers are very much related to the human realm, even though the questions were asked by celestial being. Now, his question is related to the downfall, how a particular worldly person or how a particular lay person get on to some sort of downfall. And he asks one by one, and Buddha answer one by one. And I think we have discussed to some extent. We can start from where we have stopped. And now when each and everyone is discussed, so they are actually related to our lay life. Now if you consider your life, mundane life, day-to-day household life, so all these instructions are fairly related to those lay activities. How you are maintaining your household activities, whom you are associating, how you are dealing with your money, and how you treat your children, how you treat your husband and wife. So likewise, and these are quite ordinary things that Buddha is talking here. And when one is maintaining a proper attitude, proper association, proper relationship, then of course it is leading to the advancement or the growth, progress. On the other hand, if we are neglecting those and getting on to some wrong relationships and wrong behaviors, then we are getting to the track of the downfall. Now, when he's asking about the previous question, now say, Itihetang ujanama panchamoso parabhavo chattamang bhagava bruhi king parabhavo tomukha. So several things now Buddha already discussed. Actually, five reasons for downfall, Buddha already discussed that as we discussed last time. Now he's asking the sixth one. Now Buddha is mentioning Pahutavitto Puriso Sahiranyo Sahojano Eko Bhunjati Sadhuni Tam Parabhavato Mukham. Now this is an interesting thing. Now you can see how Buddha admonish about the sharing of wealth. If a person with abundant wealth, endowed with bullion and food, eats delicacies alone, that is the cause of downfall. Now you can see, it is not that Buddha simply wants people to enjoy themselves, but rather he encourage sharing with others. Now here Buddha mention if someone is well-to-do, but he don't consider about the well-being of the others, he is quite selfish. And he has abundance of food and all the other wealth, but he never want to share it with others. Maybe his poor relatives or parents or friends or whoever, he don't want to share, but he alone trying to satisfy his senses based on the wealth he has. So Buddha mentioned this is a cause of downfall. It's actually difficult to recognize now in today's economic terms. It appear like this is what we need to do. So if we are earning with a lot of effort, so why should we need to share it with others? So if they want, they have to spend time, they have to work hard, and they should earn. So that is what we discussed during the last time's Kasi Bharadwaja Sutta. When Buddha approached Kasi Bharadwaja, he mentioned you also better do the farming and make a occupation, and then using which you can earn some money. So that is what the typical approach that people are having. But here Buddha mentioned, if one has abundant wealth and a lot of food and everything, if he is not sharing that with others, that could be a reason of downfall. Actually, we can think in different way. Probably when he is not sharing it and he is fairly maintaining kind of a miserly attitude, then of course many others may don't have any kind of a loving kind of atmosphere with him. Rather, he may get somewhat loneliness or disappointments, or even sometimes people start hating him, recognizing him as a miser, kind of a selfish person. And then of course there are certain thieves also can come and steal what he has. But on the other hand, when he is sharing things what he has, so there are other people who are looking after him, who is wishing him well. And there are many other friends. And likewise, I mean, he is not alone. Then he is fairly coordinating with others, living with others, moving well with others. Then he basically being protected because of his way of handling things. So on the other hand, if he having enough wealth, if he is not sharing and using them in a selfish manner, Buddha mentioned it's a cause of downfall. Now, after mentioning this, again this celestial being mentioned, Itihetang vijanama chattamu so parabhavo sattamam bhagava bruhi kim parabhava tomuka. So I understood this sixth case of downfall. Please explain me the seventh factor which is causing downfall. Now Buddha mentioned, jatittaddo dhanattaddo gottattaddo cha yonaro sanyatin atimanyeti tam parabhavato mukam. Now these are very interesting things that are going to happen to us. So jatittaddo, a person proud because of his social class. Now we know in our society many different classes are there. Some are coming from one clan, another come from another clan. Actually, in the modern world, somewhat this caste system is fairly not that recognized. But still, in certain societies, this caste system is very strongly recognized, and people are basically taking care of that. And the high caste people are always with a lot of proudness, a lot of conceit. And they actually look down the others. They don't want to be with the others. They don't want to sit with the low caste person. They don't want to share their belongings with another person, because they feel that they are belonging to the high caste. So these are not uncommon even today. People sometimes have this kind of a caste system. And not only caste system, sometimes they have their, say, professionalism. Say, certain professions. So they only want to move with their caliber people. They don't want to move with the others. So they are having their high ranks. So these high rankers only move with the high rankers. They don't want to move with the others. So they are having this kind of a social classes. They prepare artificially these classes. As a result of that, they have a lot of conceit, and looking others with a little sarcastic manner. Now, jati taddo. So this can happen even through the birth. Now, suppose during the Buddha's time, there are four caste systems: Brahmana, Vaishya, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. So Brahmins are the ones who think that they are the best. Kshatriyas are the ones basically more into the ruling stuff. On the other hand, the Vaishyas are the ones who are engaged with various economic activities. Shudras are the ones who are very much behaving like the servants to all the other clans. Now, if one is born to a high class, high clan, high caste, so then as a result of that, he can conceited with because of the class system, because of his high caste. Now he is looking down the other lower caste. And this can happen even when one is quite wealthy. If he's a really rich person, because of the wealth he has, again the conceit can happen. So his mind becomes fairly rigid. He never listened to another person. So he become quite proud because of the wealth he has. Gottattaddho. So again, that is the clan system. Either through the birth, he is having kind of a high caste, and again, he is having a lot of conceit. He has a lot of wealth. As a result of that, he can have a lot of conceit, proud. And again, because of the clan, he can have a lot of conceit. Sanyati atimanyeti. And sometimes he even looks down the other relatives. Now suppose one is born into a Brahmin family and he is well-to-do and he has earned a lot of money. He is quite wealthy. But there may be other relatives who are still quite poor. Now this wealthy person may feel proud and he look down the others. And this can even happen because of the education. Say someone is quite educated. He earned several degrees from a reputed university. Now he has some sort of a proudness, conceit. As a result of that, he looked down the others because he know, okay, he is the one fairly educated. He is the one who became the first in the, say, country or village or whatever it is. And he is now well recognized. All are respecting him. Now he become quite proud because of that. And as a result of that, he feel fairly proud, conceited. And always he consider that he is the best. He is the superior person when compared with the others. And Buddha mentioned, tam para bhavato mukha. This is a cause of downfall. Actually, this might not happen immediately. Now, when you are thinking about this situation, probably you want to see how these people are get on to downfall. It might not happen immediately. That's also something that we can look into, because the karma also operates in a different manner. As we know, sometimes people are doing some wrong things, but still they continue to maintain a very luxurious life without getting into any kind of a trouble, because even though they do wrong things. But on the other hand, there are people who are quite innocent and trying to do the correct things, trying to abide by the Dhamma, but still get into many troubles and go through some hardships. So people are questioning why this happens. There are a lot of unseen situations also available. We can see only a limited scenarios, but there are various other things which we can't understand. There are a lot of karma activities still giving results, still bearing fruits. And sometimes the present wrong activities, their karma being fairly covered by those strong kusala karma they have done in the past lives, previous occasions. So likewise, till the past wholesome karma is giving fruits, today's unwholesome karma power may be fairly subsided. So that we can't actually see the big picture. We only see the present or the recent past activities, but actually only the Buddha can see the complete picture. As a result of that, we can't immediately come to a conclusion that even though they are doing bad, how they are maintaining a luxurious or well-to-do life. That may be because of the past karma, which we can't see. But on the other hand, in the long run, if they are continuing to do wrong things, like just we discussed, maintaining kind of a really conceited mindset and looking down the others, condemning the others. And if someone is doing that, so that karma may slowly accumulate and others are fairly maintaining kind of an unpleasant attitude towards that person. And slowly that wrong karma or unwholesome karma may accumulate, and later in the future, he may get into the cycle of downfall. And after Buddha explained that, so again that celestial being mentioned, iti hetam vijanama sattamoso parabahu. Attamam bhagava bruhi kim parabahu tomukam. So I have get known this, the sixth or seventh reason of downfall. Please preach me the eighth one. Now Buddha is trying to preach the eighth one. Itti dutto sura dutto akka dutto cha yonaru. Laddang laddang vinaseti tam parabhavato mukam. Itti dutto. A person is a womanizer. Then sura dutto. He is fond of liquor. He is an alcoholic. Akka dutto. He is addicted to gambling. Laddang laddang vinaseti. Whatever he receive, whatever he earn, now there are enough causes to destroy. Tam parabhavato mukam. He is getting to the downfall. Now these are quite obvious. If a person is married, has a loving wife, and still he is not happy, and he is going after many other women. Actually, there's another verse coming very much close to that. Now he's a womanizer. So he's quite with a lot of sexual desires. Want to have social, kind of socializing with the other women. So kind of a womanizer. So those kind of characters are there. So they may have to spend a lot of money because women are also asking so many things. Now he has to spend a lot of money in order to satisfy them. Now, of course, even though he may do several jobs, probably he can't satisfy the needs. He's associating many women, and they never allow him to save money. Rather, all the money that he earned may ultimately being spent for many women. On the other hand, suradutto. So when someone is an alcoholic, so he alone is not the one maybe participating into a party or getting to a bar or whatever it is. But there are many other friends who are taking the benefit. So now whatever money he is earning is all spent for alcohol and to the bad friends that he is associating. Now if a person is having a lot of money and he is an alcoholic, so then many others appear like friends because they also want to have a drink. Now he's ultimately become quite poor. Probably you can remember even during the Buddha's time, a person who still had the opportunity to become an arahant ultimately become a beggar because he has become an alcoholic. Now these things are not rare in the society. We have seen that many people unfortunately have become alcoholic. Now they are fairly addicted to that, very difficult to come out of it, even though the good friends may be asking him, advising him, maybe wife is asking, children are asking, still the father may be an alcoholic. Now the whole family may suffer because whatever the money that he earn have to spend on alcohol and maybe spend on behalf of the bad friends. Ultimately, he has nothing to spend on behalf of the family. So the whole family may get into a big trouble. So these things are not uncommon. So many, many troubles are there in every country because of this addiction to alcohol. So therefore, Buddha mentioned that's a cause of downfall. And again, the akkadutto. So people are quite used to gambling. So many methods are there to gamble today. Now maybe in the good old days, only a few methods are available. But nowadays, there are many, many methods are available. Maybe using the internet. Maybe using going to a particular place like casino and all these things. So many gambling techniques are available, and people are spending millions of money, spending a lot of time, and ultimately become completely bankrupt. It's a cause of downfall. So these are not difficult to understand. So Buddha very clearly mentioned, so what are the causes of downfall? Now here actually certain parameters are fairly affecting the economy. On the other hand, certain parameters, certain causes are really affecting his social status, the family well-being. So many directions that we can see how the downfall may happen. It is not only the economic downfall we can see that Buddha talks here, but many other different levels of downfall we can recognize. Now, if he is continuously addicted to alcohol, of course, the health may deteriorate. He may encounter many, diseases. So that's also a kind of a downfall. His health may downfall. So likewise, we can recognize various attributes in this Parabhava Sutta. Itihetam vijanama attamoso parabhavo navamang bhagava bruhi tam parabhava tomukha kim parabhava tomukha. Now the celestial being, they were mentioned, okay, I understood the eighth cause, please explain me the ninth cause. Sehi darehi asantutto vesiyasu padissati dissati paradaresu tam parabhava tomukha. Now this is directly mentioned. Now it's a that's a family person. He has his own wife, but he is not contented with his own wife. Now he is going towards the prostitutes. And or sometimes probably have seen with others' wives. Like we just discussed about the womanizer. Now here also very much like that. Either he is going towards the prostitutes or he can be seen with someone else's wives. So there also Buddha mentioned it's a cause of downfall. Now you can see these are quite common things. It's not only unique in the present day, but rather those are even available during the Buddha's time. So this is the human realm. So we all always get into these kind of situations. People are going after women, or people are going after gambling, or going after alcohol. So this is the human nature. So in a way, we can understand how unsatisfactory this world is. What a kind of a mess is this world. So even though we want to have a really good, cultured, polite, or ethical world, that may be the sort of target, that may be the objective of the society, but very difficult to have such society. Even though people are educated, even though people are rich, still, if we consider their behavior, sometimes it is not acceptable. Even though they are, maintaining a very high class state, still sometimes they are alcoholics. Still they are maintaining some wrong relationships. Even though a person has his own family, maybe several children, they are also maybe learning and all these things are happening, but still going after other women. So we can recognize, so what a kind of a society that we are living with. Actually, we just discussed only about the male side, but maybe common to the female side as well. So this is the human nature we can understand. So always particularly going after this sexual feelings, sensuality. So the kama chanda, the sensual desires are strongly operating in the mind. So one of the important aspect of kama chanda is not being satisfied with what we have, what one has. Suppose one person is a married person, he is living with his own wife. But kama chanda, the strong kama chanda sensual desire he has, does not allow him to be satisfied with that woman. Now he is searching for something else. So that's the property of the hindrance kama chanda. So now when it comes to, meditation, so we know that when we are trying to keep our mind on a particular object, so mind doesn't want to be there. So when it is there for a while, so it gets bored. Now this mind want to go to another object. After a while, again it gets bored. Now it jumps to another object. So likewise, this jumping behavior, not being satisfied with the selected object, is what the purpose of the kamachanda, sensual desire. So that is fairly strongly or in a rough way represented in this adultery, going after many women, something like that. So because of the operation of the kamachanda. But the opposite is developed when one is developing samadhi, where mind is capable of being with the selected object for a long time. It's a kind of a skill that one has to develop purposely. At the beginning, it is very, very difficult because mind is used to jump. Mind can't bear the boredom. So when one associates a single thing, a selected object, so after a while, he feels bored. That's the nature of the mind. Because of the operation of the sensual desire, kama chanda. But if one want to properly tame it, one way of taming it is to develop the concentration. Okay, he is now taming with anapanasati, for example. Again and again, keeping his attention on breath. So breath also very bored object, very monotonous object. But slowly, because of our training, now mind get used to be with the breath. Now person can easily be with, say, 50 breaths, easily be with 100 breaths, easily be with 150 breaths. So likewise, this ability can be developed. So this ability, samadhi, concentration, is completely opposite to kamachanda, completely opposite to sensual desire. So if one has the ability to stay quietly with the selected object, that means his kamachanda, the sensual desire, has fairly calmed down. But on the other hand, this is not the way to completely uproot kamachanda. But on the other hand, it's a temporary subsiding of kamachanda. But if one wants to uproot kamachanda, it's a long process that we need to develop mindfulness. We have to have a fair amount of concentration. With that develop mindfulness and concentration, one has to continue with the investigation, vipassana. As a result of that, one may be able to understand the true nature of the conditioned phenomena. So kind of a vipassana approach that one has to take, so that in the future, or once one is capable, he can recognize kamachanda as kamachanda. Actually, at the beginning, he being driven by kamachanda. He being driven by sensual desire. He's a slave to kamachanda. But now, when sensual desire arising in the mind, he can step back and look at sensual desire. Rather than being a slave to sensual desire, now he can simply objectively look at sensual desire, how it is arising in the mind. Now he can take an action. Rather than being a slave to it, he can simply abandon kamachanda, abandon sensual desire. So understanding one's own or understanding the availability of kamachanda is something that Buddha really appreciated or praised, because that is the beginning of one's evolution of the life, we can say. Because previously he is being driven by defilements, but now he is capable of recognizing the defilements as defilements, or kamachanda, sensual desire, as sensual desire, rather than being a victim of sensual desire. Now, we can see what is the criteria that we need to operate when we understand sensual desire. That is the letting go. Rather than satisfying that sensual desire, one has to recognize it and simply allow it to pass by. So that is the way to slowly abandon sensual desire, weaken sensual desire, and maybe ultimately completely uproot sensual desire. So there are many other things that we can discuss, like understanding the impermanent behavior of the conditioned phenomena, and how unsatisfactory they are, and how non-governable they are. So these are the various insights that one may understand. So those are also may be supportive in this whole process. And maybe later, his mind may associating a particular state which is completely free from kamachanda, completely free from sensual desire. So these are the things I like to share with you on today's Dhamma sermon. Now we can get into the questions.
Avasaramante.
Yeah.
Today we have 7 questions. And first question is related to the mindful walking. Dear Bhante, thank you for your practical advice to write down and forget about the thoughts, which can be quite difficult to get rid of while on the walking path. While walking, I get these new ideas about work or some other activity when the mind drifts to thoughts. When I write down these, it is very easy to forget them and come back to the walking process. Hope this is not a bad habit if I do it mindfully with metta. That is the end of the question.
Yeah, no problem. Actually, we can use many methods. So if you are now familiar with the writing down part, that is good. Whatever is comfortable to you. So I don't need to particularly mention, okay, this is the only method. So whatever is comfortable to you, ultimately the result is that your mind is fairly relaxed, because maintaining everything in the mind, remembering everything, could be a little burden to the mind. So as we are progressing in the practice, probably mind prefer to be a little alone without being burdened. So in order to do that, we can facilitate by keeping things in writing, or putting it to a note, or putting it to a calendar. So whatever the way, so that mind is fairly clean, not considering things as a burden, but the whatever the techniques available today, we can make use of. Now the various gadgets are available today, electronics are available today, reminders are available. So whatever the techniques available today can be used so that our mind is not burdened. Yeah.
Second question out of 7. Dear Venerable Sir, mindful walking. I focus on the lower body and the sole of my foot when starting to walk. My walking path is about 20 steps. I can feel the weight of the body transferring along the sole, and I use left and right, noting when I feel these sensations on my left and right foot respectively. I can feel the differences of them as well. After 5 to 10 rounds of attempt, I can continuously keep the attention on the sensations. When this happens, noting of left and right drops automatically. I start hearing the high frequency noise as well, which you mentioned some time ago. I can walk in the background of this ringing sound without any distraction. During this time, noting is dropped, and I also details of the sensations. During this time, noting is dropped and also details of the sensations. I can feel the pressure when the foot touches, but not much details of it. Is this something similar to what Venerable mentioning sometimes back about vitakka vichara getting subsided? Much merits for your explanation and for this program with metta. That is the end of the question.
Yeah, I think we haven't yet come to the drop of vitakka vichara, but we are still in the vitakka vichara. Actually, in the vipassana practice, a fair amount of time we are dealing with vitakka vichara. So again and again, when we are recognizing each and every sensation, so that is where we are applying our mind. Now suppose while walking on your heel, that assume that there's a sensation happen. So you apply your mind there. Now you closely examine there. So the applied mind is there, the close examination, vichara, is also there. Now suppose your foot is touching the ground and you recognize another sensation, maybe available in a toe. So now you apply your mind there, vitakka is there. Again you do close examination, vichara is there. So the vitakka vichara is continuously very quickly happening, and we are making use of those skills to recognize their true nature. So we allow things to happen naturally, and we are quickly, very much like examining, quickly investigating. So vitakka vichara is continuously operating. And as you have mentioned, only at the beginning we need to use noting. Later, once you are confident, you can drop it and simply do the process with a quiet mind. That is pretty good.
Third question out of 7. This is related to mindful sitting, and it is a very long question anyway. Dear Bhante, much merits for this invaluable program, which helped me to learn the mindfulness technique and build a regular practice. My reflection and question is regarding the sitting practice. I have written several reports regarding how my sitting practice progress around observation of the breath and then ending up in a calm, relaxed, silent space when the breath fades away. Bhante's guidance on how to get used to this unattached state was excellent, and I can access my acceptance, appreciation and improvement in staying in this state for a continuous period. The thoughts or distractions appear in the state seems to be quite different than the thoughts I have in normal day-to-day mind state. For an example, if I get a lustful thought while on practice and in the relaxed state, there is nothing much of a difference of it from the anger or laminating thought, unless I decide to delve in and get more excited. This seems to be a choice that I can make consciously. On the other hand, if in a normal day-to-day mind state, a lustful thought seems to be more colorful and heavy with all the attractions which overwhelm me most of the time. This is due to the presence and absence of the intenses, Bhante. I can identify the peacefulness, simplicity and serenity of the relaxed state of the practice against this heavy, colorful and sinful mind. Can this be used as part of Dhammanupassana? Appreciate Bhante's explanation. Much merits again for your valuable services. With metta, that is the end of the question.
Yeah, actually this is what exactly mentioned in the Indriya Bhavana Sutta, which is the last sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. So when we are dealing with daily activities, so again and again we encounter these kind of pleasant scenarios and unpleasant situations. So as a result of that, mind can get on to this lustful states, quite elated states, or on the other hand, kind of depressive or little uneasy, sorrowful states. So when one recognizes that the kind of healthy state of mind, the healthy state of mind is that unattached, non-grasping, unassociated, lighter, spacious, empty state of mind. So that is the most healthiest state of mind. So the Buddha's advice is, so once you know that mind has distracted, mind has now feel burdened because of that lustful thought, now it is your responsibility to quickly come back to that restful state, quickly come back to that equanimous state. So Buddha actually encouraged to do that. So now we have all the situations available in our hand. We have the experience of the experience of the equanimous, unattached, spacious, empty state of the mind, healthy state of the mind. That also we have experienced. And again, we know the how burning it is, the lustful thought. And again, we have probably how hateful, how difficult burning is a hateful thought. Now all the different scenarios are available. But now we need to sort of promote the mind to always try to dwell in that healthy state of mind. The kind of a choice we have. So what happens usually is that when we are getting to a lustful state, it has some kind of a delight. So we get attached to that. We want to enjoy that. So as a result of that, we don't want to drop it. And on the other hand, when we are in an angry state, again, we feel that I am correct, he is wrong. So I want to, so the sense of self is quite strong. And as a result of that, I don't want to lose it. So these are the difficulties that we may encounter in this practice. But slowly, we have to abandon those states and come back, return back again and again to that equanimous state. So it is true. Now, as you have mentioned, say while you are in the practice, probably you can do it quite easily because the hindrance power is less and your wholesome power, the indriya faculty power is fairly strong. As a result of that, you can quickly do it. But later, in the day-to-day activities, in a daily time or in a usual time, it may be a little difficult because you are being easily carried away by the lustful thought. But now you have to have a little bit of sense restraint. You have to remember that how the way that you need to maintain your mind, not being distracted to a lustful thought, but rather try to dwell in that emptiness, dwell in that calmness, tranquility, equanimity. So all these teachings that we have to teach again and again towards the mind, because it's very much like a child. So child is still don't know the consequences well. So it's the parent who has to warn him, educate him, so that the child may slowly understand it.
Yeah, 4 questions out of 7. This is a general question. Dear Bhante, I am trying to practice as many times a week as possible and trying hard these days. But during day-to-day interactions, I get very angry, frustrated and sad by other people's acts. I always want to correct them and blame them, maybe due to the mindful practice. I get alarmed by my negative thoughts and stop before any verbal or physical action, which might be the reason to save my marriage and the job so far. But I don't know how to calm myself down other than seeing my fault and eruption. Thank you for your advice. That is the end of the question.
Yeah, I think that is also true. Because when we develop mindfulness, so we understand our own shortcomings, someone else's shortcomings. But again, on the other hand, we have to have a fair amount of self-compassion. So when we know that we have a lot of anger, we have a lot of lust, we have a lot of jealousy, still mind get distracted, still mind is restless. So we can't immediately correct this whole thing. So we have to have a lot of patience. We have to have a lot of self-empathy. Self-compassion, and these are the qualities that we have to therefore take in parallel with the mindfulness practice, because the mindfulness is capable of showing us all the different faults, shortcomings we have, but the solution is not immediate. So you have to have certain other mechanisms to slowly calm down and continue the practice, but with the continuation of the practice, all these shortcomings may become weaker and weaker. So similarly, when we see someone else's fault, rather than immediately jumping to the situation and trying to argue or correct him, still we need to understand, okay, I am practicing, still I can't behave well, still I can't overcome all my shortcomings. Then how come this person, who not being a practitioner, how he can correct himself? He's very much like helpless. He's in a bad situation, even worse situation than me. So likewise, we have to understand the situation, have kind of compassion towards handling these things. I can understand your situation, but have to have a lot of patience in the practice, again to have a fair amount of compassion to handle the situation. Maybe in a later time, we are in a situation to properly handle it. And even if you want to correct another person, probably you can do it in a soft tone. without getting into anger, without being emotional, probably how to address that particular person at the right time with correct words. So these are the things that we have to slowly learn, that none of us are, say, 100% we can do it. Sometimes we're getting wrong and sometimes mess up things, or sometimes properly able to handle things. So these are the ways that we have to slowly handle. I think it's a kind of a lifetime job.
Fifth question out of nine. This is a general question. Dhamma sermon question. Dear Bhante, I was referring some sutta within bracket Dittikatha and came across that even clinging within bracket Tanha and avicca are kind of a ditti within brackets wrong view. If we take it as a personal me and mind view. But when we practice mindfulness and understand that the primary causes are tanha and avicca for most of the thoughts, there is kind of a bookkeeping which is associated with the view of accounting under me and myself. If we go beyond that and try to contemplate, this is not mine and not associated with me, I feel like it is not possible to do that kind of a bookkeeping and develop an overall awareness. Much merits for clarification, this subtle point, Bhante, with metta. That's the end of the question.
Actually, bookkeeping may be necessary to some extent, but later actually when mind want to be secluded, mind want to be unbothered, say mind prefer more of a kind of restful state, then even the bookkeeping become a little bit of a burden. So whatever happens, it immediately abandon and try to dwell in a more relaxed state. Therefore, we can't always say that the bookkeeping is a must. At the beginning, it is true. Now, say when you start developing mindfulness, so slowly you understand, okay, at this particular task, I can be mindful. Another task, I can be mindful. But in this particular task, I can't be mindful. So likewise, the bookkeeping process starts like. Later, you can easily maintain that. You know exactly what has happened, so your memory is very refreshed, working well. So these things are developing in such a manner. But later, there may be a situation that mind is not interested of bookkeeping. That's what we discussed as the first question. Now, mind prefers to be alone. Mind prefers to be very much like restful, not associated with things, not taking any burden. On such situation, actually, we can use various other mechanisms. And therefore, I can say, so allow it to happen. So we can't expect the same quality of mind every day, every time, and during the process of vipassana. So it may go through with different ups and downs. It's a matter of bearing things, adjusting things. And I think that would be the way to handle it.
Yeah. Sixth question out of nine. This is relevant to mindful sitting. Dear Bhante, during the guiding for sitting meditation, you said, if your mind is drifting, please pay attention to breathing or rising and falling. Otherwise, try to observe relaxed moment. What is the meaning of relaxed moment? And what do we need to look there? Is there a moment without having any thoughts? Much merits. That is the end of the question.
Yeah, I mean, if you are already recognized such kind of relaxed moment or kind of thoughtless state, so then probably you can come to that. So it's, different approaches are there. It is not that always the same technique that one has to use. Different techniques are there. And say, for example, if you are still a beginner and your mind get distracted, so you are very much like the savior, you are very much like the relief is again and again coming back to the breath. So assume that the breath is your primary object. So breath becomes your very much like the primary object. So again and again, it is your duty to associate breath. But later, say for example, you are practicing even vipassana, and you are recognizing unassociated state of mind, non-grasping state of mind. So as we just discussed, again assume that mind get distracted. Again, a lustful thought arising. Now we may have several options at this situation, because now you are a vipassana yogi who has some hands-on experience. So now you have several options. One option is maybe you can bring your attention back to the breath. You can bring your attention back to any kind of bodily sensation. So those may be one option. But on the other hand, if you know, okay, there is a state of mind which is unassociated, non-grasping. Can't I keep my attention there? It is always available. Now say for example, assume that you are drawing a picture on a canvas. So why are we always looking at the picture and being distracted, being deluded by the picture? Can't we see the canvas? Because of the picture, is the canvas being destroyed? No, canvas is always available. Similarly, so when mind get distracted, probably if we know, okay, there's the mind has the quality like a canvas, like that silence, awareness. So we can use the awareness as a refuge, returning back to that awareness. Okay, you are coming back, stepping back, looking at it objectively. Now we being distracted, fine, I understood that. Okay, now again I step back, now I am looking at it objectively. So many options are there.
Okay, 7, question of 9, that is related to the Dhamma sermon. Venerable Bhante, many merits to you for these Dhamma sessions. Is Parabhava Sutta about financial downfalls only? I find some of those causes could lead to mental downfalls as well. That is the end of the question.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, those can be getting to mental downfall, economic downfall, social downfall, say health downfall, many, that's what I mentioned. So it is into multifacet, multidirectional downfall we can discuss actually.
Eighth question out of 9. This is also a Dhamma sermon question. Bhante said, need to let go of defilement. How does one let go, please? Does one need to reflect wisely? See the downside, etc. Thank you, Bhante. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That is the end of the question.
Yeah, there are also many approaches are there. Now, say for example, when a defilement, when a wrong thought, unwholesome thought arising in the mind, so one option is to use the opposite type of thought. Now, suppose there's a lustful thought and you understand it's sort of starting to develop. Now, one way of handling it is to develop the or think the other side. Maybe the loathsomeness of the body, maybe about the death, whatever it is. So, you are using the opposite thoughts to subside that thought. So, that may be one option. And on the other hand, when you understand a kind of unwholesome thought, so probably you understand there are danger. If you are maintaining such thought in your mind for a long time, again and again mind start burning and you being start sort of defiled and going away from the Nibbana, going away from your wisdom. So likewise you understand the, and again it is harmful to you, harmful to another person. So likewise you understand the consequences, the danger. That so when you understand the danger, again you are able to overcome that. And probably another option is the letting go. Say it is there, but you simply, in order to do that, you need to have a fair amount of mindfulness. So once you recognize it, now you stop feeding it. You are not participating into it. Now you simply disconnect your connection between the defilement and yourself. And now it slowly gets abandoned, because You are the one feeding it. You are the one adding strength to it. Now you have stopped it. As a result of that, it slowly fades away. It's a kind of a letting go process. So likewise, and probably you can completely distract yourself to something else. Say you have seen something, someone, something, and your mind gets started, say, developing some anger. Now, as a way of overcoming that, probably you get distracted and start listening to music. Another method. So likewise, many methods are available. Actually, 5 methods are mentioned in the Vitakka Santhana Sutta of Majjhima Nikaya. You also can refer that.
Okay. And the final question, Bhante. This is a general question. Dear Bhante, thank you for your valuable advice. What guidance do you have for practicing meditation when sick? I recently got COVID and could not do the walking or guided sitting meditation today. Instead, I lay down and focused on rising and falling of chest. This relaxed my body and I felt less sick. Appreciate your advice with metta. That is the end of the question.
Yeah, good. I mean, many methods are available. Maybe paying attention to rising and falling, and probably, I mean, if not, if you can bear, if you can be patient, you can pay attention to various sensations available, various aches, pains available, discomfort available. And on the other hand, you can listen to Dhamma. Because sometimes when we are sick, it's a bit difficult to collect ourselves. So we don't have the same energy we had, same enthusiasm we had. But when we are listening to Dhamma, while we are sick, so that is again uplifting ourselves. So we understand, okay, again I can bring myself, I can develop myself. So Dhamma is giving fair amount of encouragement. And so likewise, listening to Dhamma is also very useful when we are sick. So that is why you know that the Bojjhanga Suttas are available. When Buddha was sick, when Mahamoggallana was sick, when Mahakassapa was sick, so they used to preach Dhamma, particularly on the Bojjhangas. Whatever the topic, actually, we can use. So some Dhamma sermons are really inspiring and helping us to sort of accept the, say, the pain we are going through, accept the sickness rather than sort of get into a wrong way of looking at it. Rather than thinking that this is, I am suffering, I am sick. How about looking at it like this is sickness, there is suffering. So then we are very much like practicing the first noble truth. So the suffering or the sickness is part of the first noble truth. So there is suffering. It's not that I am suffering. It is not that I am sick. Rather, there is sickness. There is uncomfortable feelings. There is uneasiness. There is weakness. So likewise, if we are able to look at in that angle, that also helps.
Okay. That was the last question, Bhante.
Yeah.
We come to the end of the program. I would first like to thank Bhante for his valuable time. Also, we would like to pass our merits to everyone, both seen and unseen, who are enabling this program. And we pass our merits to all participants for joining the program. With that, I would like to conclude the program today. Teruvan Saranai. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Teruvan Saranai.